Hello, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. We also welcome our listening audiences, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Our program tonight is Spring 2017, an update on the Sierra Nevada's rain, snowpack, and climate changes, fire, beetles, water resources, and dying trees. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guests. Guest panel, Bob Kingman, Executive Officer of the Sierra Nevada Conservancy, Scott Tangenberg, who is the Acting Forest Supervisor, Stanislaus National Forest, Patrick Kopal, Executive Director of the Tuolumne River Trust, and Michael Carlin, who's Deputy General Manager, San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. We'll start with Bob.
Thank you, Ann. Thank you very much. We very much appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to our friends in San Francisco and other metropolitan areas around the state of California. I do have to make one slight correction. I'm only the assistant executive officer right now. So if Jim Branham, our executive officer, hears that, he's going to think I gave you the wrong information. But we very much appreciate it. We've got a lot of information to cover in a short amount of time about a really big area. The Sierra Nevada Conservancy jurisdiction extends over 25 million acres, includes all or part of 22 counties in California. It's about a quarter of California. And we put this presentation together because we want to ask the question, why do we care about this stuff? Why is it important? So the number one reason that I can think of, and I hope the things load quickly here, but the number one reason I can think of why the Sierra Nevada is important, particularly to residents of California, is it's the primary supplier of 60% of California's developed water supply. So when you think about the communities, the ranching industry, all of the industrial uses for water across California, this is where most of that water comes from. It doesn't come out of a tap. It doesn't come out of the delta originally. It comes down from the snowpack in the mountains in the Sierra Nevada and then helps support the rest of the state. Another thing that's near and dear to all of us, and I imagine there's not a person in this room that doesn't have some kind of a connection to the Sierra Nevada for the recreation or tourism opportunities that it provides. It's really important not only to the people, the citizens of California, but people around the world. California is home to a $120 billion annual travel and tourism industry. It's one of the largest industries in California, and a large part of that those offerings are in the Sierra Nevada region. Something else that a lot of you will connect with are the habitat values that the Sierra Nevada brings. It's one of the most biologically diverse areas in the state of California. The number of animal species in the Sierra Nevada are extremely high and dependent upon the health of our Sierra Nevada forests for continued survival, not only for their own benefit, for the benefit of anglers and sportsmen alike. I've lumped all of these together because they're all sort of inextricably combined. Carbon sequestration is a big topic. The Sierra Nevada should be and has been one of the largest sequesters of carbon, but we're approaching a point in time where that's about to capitulate. With the current health of the Sierra Nevada forests, we're starting to see the prospect that our forests become bigger emitters than sequesters. And that should be a real a bell ringer for all of us to start paying really critical attention to this. Now, closely associated with that are air quality and the public health benefits that air quality brings with it, and also the public health challenges that come when we have huge, huge smoke events. And those typically come from the unmanaged, out-of-control, high-severity wildfires. Today, many of our forests are not healthy as a result of decades of aggressive fire suppression. We've become, our society, Western United States, has become the experts in the world at putting out fires, and we're great at putting them out. And we've built an entire industry around doing that. And part of the result of that is that we've interrupted the natural fire regime that used to manage the forests naturally. So I think ultimately we need to get back to a state of some more fire on the ground, managed or controlled types of fire activities on the ground. Add that to restrictions in mechanical restoration work on the ground. Fire is not going to solve all the problem. We need to look at a combined, a combination of different types of management activities to restore our forests to resiliency. Add to that some of the events of the last 5 years. If you haven't been up in the Sierra, and especially the Central or Southern Sierra in the last 3 or 4 years, you're in for a big change. Some of you may have seen the effects of some of the large damaging fires, but there's an entirely different landscape that you'll see that I'm sure some of my colleagues will talk about around tree mortality as a result of impacts from drought and beetle infestation. Entire landscapes now are brown. It's really sad, and it's creating a situation that is highly susceptible to high-intensity fires, and its impacts spread and impact all of those values that we talked about at the beginning here. You start to see that the combination of the tree mortality, the drought issues, the high-severity fire, and just the general decrease in the health of the forest is starting to take its toll on habitat, on decreased access for public recreation and tourism, on public health consequences around smoke inhalation and so forth. You might be asking, how does the health of the forest or the decline in the health of the forest impact our water supply? The photograph that you see here is a picture on the South Fork of the American River that was taken 5 years after the Cleveland fire, which happened in 1992. This was taken shortly after the floods of 1997, and massive landslide occurred, depositing tons and tons and tons of sediment into the South Fork of the American River. This scenario plays out up and down the Sierra Nevada, and this year in particular, we're waiting for the bill to come due on what we're going to get, because we've had just an extraordinary precipitation year this year, and we're waiting right now. A lot of our folks on the national forests and the public lands in the Sierra Nevada are working to calculate the total impacts of this. Now, this sediment and these kinds of impacts affect hydropower delivery and affect all kinds of distribution infrastructure that I referred to earlier that supplies all the water to the rest of California. The costs to maintain these, to dredge out these things, to keep those infrastructure pieces alive is extremely high. As a matter of fact, it's probably more than it would have cost to go in and keep our forests healthy in the first place. I'm right on time. Thank you. This one's near and dear to me because I love all of these things, and I grew up in the mountains, and it breaks my heart to see the impacts on recreation and tourism in our region. So along with that inventory of impacts on our forested areas, we're going to start seeing a growing list of campgrounds, trails, fishing and hiking areas, road systems, lakes, rivers, marinas, and unfortunately, local businesses that depend on this close. Access to these to a lot of these resources are not going to be available. And so if the access isn't there, then the ripple effect happens, and it's not, you know, there will be what we've come to take for granted, I think, is going to change. Our access to that is gonna change. And the marketability of California and the whole underpinning of a lot of California's tourism and travel economy is going to change as well. Impact to California's wildlife. We've chosen the spotted owl here as one example, but a lot of the animals here are gonna suffer from a changing forest. It's predicted within the next 75 years, if we stay on the route that we're on with a number of high severity fires, that suitable habitat for this particular species will be non-existent. We're burning them up. This owl habitat is disappearing. Same goes for all kinds of fish species. They rely on those rivers for spawning and reproduction, and if they're all silted in, then that goes away too. So you start messing with the web of life, and it only takes a few species to screw up the whole web. This is really interesting, and particularly, addresses the audience here at hand, because it draws a connection to San Francisco. Emissions from the Rim Fire in 2013 equaled the estimated emissions of the entire city of San Francisco for a whole year. That's over a two-week period. And that pales in comparison to the ultimate emissions that are going to emanate from that burn scar over the years as those dead trees decay. And most of that will be in the form of methane, which is a worse gas for greenhouse effects. So restoring resiliency to our forests really is the only solution that we have. We need to start paying attention to this. We need to make investments in this, and it needs to be seen as investments. These are not expenses. These are investments. These are investments in our future and in our children's future and our grandchildren's future. We need to be thinking about a whole suite of management activities to manage our forests, including sound thinning and harvest activities, and a definite reintroduction of prescribed and managed fire that minimizes the amount of smoke and focuses the smoke from those fires at times of year when it's not impactful to communities or recreation or tourism events or so forth. But we've got to get back to that. So the Sierra Nevada Conservancy has, in partnership with the U.S. Forest Service, has implemented the Sierra Nevada Watershed Improvement Program, what we call the WIP. It is the beginning of a program that is looking at attracting a tremendous amount of resources, the resources that are going to be needed to restore our forests to resiliency, to address and make sure that all of those values that I outlined in the beginning here continue on in perpetuity. Thank you, Anne, for mentioning the report. This is our second update of the state of Sierra Nevada forests. There's a lot of interesting information in here. Some of the things I've touched on are all included in the report. Please take it back. It's available online. There should be enough here for everyone in the room. If not, be happy to get some to you and happy to answer questions when my turn comes up. So I think I made it. Great. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Scott Tannenberg, Acting Forest Supervisor of the Stanislaus National Forest. Scott?
Thank you very much, Ann. So from a Sierra-wide perspective that Bob just shared with you to a slightly more focused perspective, I'm a Acting Forest Supervisor for the Stanislaus National Forest, roughly 1 million acres, directly east from here and home to much of the water that comes for the consumption of San Francisco residents. Certainly, the impacts that Bob discussed that are occurring Sierra-wide are hitting the Stanislaus in particular in a very hard way. Tree mortality is occurring in an unprecedented fashion, things that have never been measured before. And that tree mortality is a result of 5 years of drought, overcrowded forests, and an explosion in bark beetle habitat as well as bark beetle populations. California went through its fifth consecutive year of drought in 2016. 2015 was the driest year that we had ever recorded. And those trees simply don't have enough water to survive or to sustain any defense against those beetle populations. Here's a graphic showing the expansion of where tree mortality has had a major impact up and down the Sierra. That first image on the left-hand side is from 2014, where you can see not a lot of red, not a lot of yellow. Then in 2015, a significant expansion of tree mortality, particularly in the Southern Sierra, mostly south of Yosemite National Park. And then 2016, that impact spreads northward, impacting the foothill areas of the Stanislaus National Forest, and is already impacting areas of the El Dorado, Tahoe, and Plumas National Forests as well, working its way up north. Trees will continue to die across California in the next coming years, despite the record precipitation that we've received this past winter. The beetle populations are still there, and it takes cold temperatures, like really cold temperatures, like negative 50 cold temperatures, to significantly set back beetle populations. So although a wetter environment, although more soil moisture can offer those trees more ability to push out the beetles that will attack them, it does not knock back the beetle populations. So we expect those impacts to continue. Over 102 million dead trees have been recorded over the past few years, and over 91 million of those dead trees expired in 2015 and 2016. I talked about our record-setting water year. We did get a lot of moisture, not just down here, but up in the mountains as well. Those of you familiar with the Highway 120 corridor might recognize this image as Rainbow Pool, a popular day stop destination on your way to Yosemite. That picture on the left is a normal summer day. The waterfall just gently cascading over the rocks there at Rainbow Pool. And that image on the right was from February 10th of this year, where thousands of additional cubic feet of water were pouring over Rainbow Pool. Sierra-wide, we've experienced over 200% of our normal precip. And although this image doesn't show a whole lot of the impacts related to that above-average precip, these images do. You can see from the back there, that upper left-hand corner is what's left of the West Side Railroad Grade Trail. That's a popular trail out of the city of Tuolumne near Sonora. Landslide has taken away most of the trail. Picture in the upper right-hand corner is of Beardsley Road that's on its way down to the day use area at Beardsley Reservoir. This is a reservoir that's accessible up the Highway 108 corridor. Again, massive landslide and total failure of the road. Additional pictures there, a little deeper into the forest. The Hell's Hollow Road just ends. Normally it would access the power generation facilities at Donnell's Reservoir. They've had to helicopter in their maintenance supplies in order to actually get and maintain that dam. And then the Cottonwood Road, that picture was taken several weeks ago. There's only about half of the road left now. And this is a major access road for us to be able to get in to Cherry Lake. And the rest of the forest where we conduct, or we would have hoped to conduct, many of those management activities that Bob was describing that help us treat the forest and keep it healthy. So in the face of all of that, we are still trying to make a difference out there. As Bob discussed, the impacts from the Rim Fire in 2013, and we've had a chance to share those here at the Commonwealth Club in the past, were monumental. Third largest fire in California history, still the largest wildfire in the Sierra Nevada in recorded history, $1.7 billion in damage and losses, cost over $130 million to suppress, and burned over 400 square miles. This was surpassed as one of the most expensive fires in recorded history by the Sobranes fire from last year, which more than doubled this cost to suppress. Again, the cost to suppress these fires is multiple times higher than it would be the cost to actually manage these fires, manage these forests on the front end and try to reduce these impacts before they happen. Reforestation of that rim fire footprint is underway. We've had the benefit of AmeriCorps members, volunteers from a wide array of backgrounds and interests, managed, thankfully, by your next speaker and his organization, Tuolumne River Trust and Patrick Koppel, as well as Forest Service staff, whose job it is to maintain these national forests for the benefit of all people today and into the future. We're very pleased to have the assistance of our partners, the assistance of those who care enough to maintain those investments in National Forest to help bring back this landscape. You see the kids out there, my own kids, were out there planting trees. Wasn't exactly one of their funnest days, but they did it. By golly, they did it. And we've been incredibly grateful to see the outpouring of community support and hope to see that outpouring of community support maintain through the future. The rim fire burned over 250,000 acres. We've managed to reforest just over 1,000 of those acres. We hope that through the next several years, with the help of additional resources, to get a lot more reforested. And with that, I'll pause, pass it on to Patrick, and take some questions at the end. Thank you.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. And our next speaker, our program tonight, I'm sorry, Spring 2017, an update on the Sierra Nevada's rain, snowpack, climate changes, fire, beetles, water, resources, and dying trees. And our next speaker is Patrick Koppel, and he will join us now. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Thanks for having us here tonight. I don't want to scare you away with that graph. Okay, so I work for the Tuolumne River Trust, and just to start off and orient you here a little bit, this is a map of the Tuolumne River watershed. So what do I mean by watershed? Any snow or rain that falls on this patch of ground is going to flow down into the Tuolumne River. And it's an amazing river. This is, of course, this is our river. This flows, starts up in Yosemite, and one of the amazing things about the Tuolumne River is that it connects some of the most incredible places really in the world. Starts up in Yosemite National Park, iconic national park that people come from all around the world to visit. It flows down through the Stanislaus National Forest, Scott's patch of ground, and from there down into the Central Valley, which is one of the world's great producers of food, nuts, and fiber. And from there down into the Bay Delta, San Francisco Bay, and it supplies drinking water for one of the world's great cosmopolitan centers. It's a pretty neat place to focus efforts on. It's a beautiful place, and it's incredibly important. It provides drinking water for millions of people here in the Bay Area, irrigation water for hundreds of thousands of acres in the Central Valley, and recreational opportunities up in Yosemite, up in the Stanislaus National Forest, and fish and wildlife, just incredible fish and wildlife resources. what you see outlined there in red is the footprint of the rim fire in 2013, and that burned 250,000 acres of the watershed. It's about 20% of this land outlined was burned by the rim fire. So huge, had a huge impact. And it's something that we're going to be feeling the effects of for many years to come. So what I want to just focus on is what's happening kind of at the local level. What are non-governmental organizations doing and others to help out with the state of our forests in the Tuolumne watershed. And so what you see here is, of course, the impacts of drought and tree mortality. The big brown patch shows you what has been happening over the past few years. Lots of dead trees. Our forests are really in an unhealthy state. And why is that? One key reason is that we've been suppressing fires. These are fire-adapted forests. They rely on fires to come through periodically, low-intensity fires that kind of come through and burn out some of the undergrowth and sort of clean up. And for decades, there's been a practice to suppress fires throughout the West. And what this is showing is the image on the left shows some surveys that were done back in 1929. Each of the little blue circles shows a tree, and the image on the right is a more recent survey of that same patch of ground. Tree densities have really increased as a result of fire suppression over the decades. In the early 1900s, kind of pre-logging, pre-fire suppression, tree densities would have been maybe 19 to 100 trees per acre, and now you're seeing 200 to 400 trees per acre. So tremendous increase. And what does this look like? Here's a tree taken from the early photo taken from the early 1900s of what the forest kind of looked like up in the Sierra Nevada. You can see it's kind of open, not a lot of small trees, not a lot of undergrowth, and lots of big trees too, and lots of openings. So kind of clumps of trees, some widely spaced individual trees, and here's a more recent photo taken up in the Sierra, and you can see a huge increase in the number of trees. A lot of tiny little thin trees, closely packed in, not a lot of openings. And this is a recipe for major fires to come through and not just burn along the ground, but really get up in the crown and then take off. And so that's kind of the state of play that we're dealing with. and so what is the result? Tree mortality. With the drought and the high density of trees, these come together and add in the bark beetle, which is naturally occurring in the Sierra, but they have an opportunity to come through and kill millions and millions of trees. Extreme megafires. The Rim Fire was mentioned earlier, and there are places up in the Rim Fire footprint that are just completely burned over. So much so that even the organic soil was burned, and it makes it difficult for any natural regeneration to occur. Water quality is impacted. We get our water from the Sierra Nevada, San Francisco and the peninsula, gets it from Tuolumne watershed. Here's a photo before the Rim Fire on the main Tuolumne run, and here is the summer after the Rim Fire. Hopefully that comes through. Big difference. So it's important, and it's an impactful problem. The good thing is that there are some pretty unique efforts taking place up in Tuolumne County, where different groups have come together and formed something called the Yosemite Stanislaus Solutions. This is a collaboration that involves the timber industry. It involves environmental groups like Tuolumne River Trust, Sierra Club, and others. It involves biomass industry, recreational users to work together to find solutions. We know the problems that are out there, and so what are the solutions that that we can deal with? And one of the things that we recognize is that funding is a real problem. The Forest Service has massive amounts of acreage and really not enough funding to properly manage that acreage.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So the Yosemite Stanislaus Solutions was actually formed before the Rim Fire to address some of the problems that we knew were happening in the forest and to try to prevent a fire like the Rim Fire from happening. Unfortunately, change comes slowly, and we weren't able to bring together a plan in time to prevent the Rim Fire, but we certainly learned a lot of lessons and have developed what we call the Forest Resiliency Pilot Project. That the idea with this is to go out and restore the forest health, bring the resources to the forest so that we can prevent the next Rim Fire from happening or prevent the tree mortality from getting any worse. And just briefly, I want to mention some of the key elements of the pilot project. First, we need to mechanically treat some of these forests. So that means with machinery and handwork, go in and remove some of the trees from the forest to bring down the tree density overall. What is of interest to Tuolumne River Trust for ecological health is to reintroduce prescribed fire to the forest. As I mentioned earlier, these are fire-adapted landscapes. They need to have fires coming through periodically. And so if you don't have some managed fires, low-intensity fires, on a pretty regular basis, you're going to end up with infrequent, high-intensity, massive fires like the Rim Fire. So after mechanical treatment, you would come back and have prescribed fire that you burn through some of the undergrowth and brush. The third part of the pilot project is to focus on meadow health. Meadows are really important for water quality and fish and wildlife habitat. And a lot of meadows up in the Sierra have been really degraded. You can see the photo on the left shows an eroded stream flowing through a meadow. And then on the right, not a lot of vegetation. And we want to take meadows that look like this and bring them back to a meadow that looks like this, where we restore that stream that flows through the meadow and improve the water quality. So those are kind of the three legs of the Yosemite Stanislaus Solutions pilot project. And the idea is that we'll be using this concept to attract funding, attract additional resources to try to restore the health of the forests up there in the Tuolumne watershed. And leave you with this one final photo that shows you kind of a forest that had gone through some restoration. It was previously one of these densely packed, high, lots of small trees and whatnot, and subsequently had some mechanical thinning, some prescribed fire, and this is what the kind of final product would look like. So I think that's it. Thanks a lot, and we'll go on to Michael.
You have just heard from Patrick Koppel, who's the executive director of Tuolumne River Trust. This is Ann Clark, chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. And our next speaker is Michael Carlin, the deputy general manager of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. Michael?
So you've heard from our previous speakers a lot about the forest, and I'm going to talk a little bit about our water and our water supply, and also something we did this past year, which actually was in the middle of all this, tried to inspect a tunnel that we haven't been in for decades. You might think we were crazy. So this is the drought, 1992, 1987 through 1992 drought. This is what Hetch Hetchy Reservoir looked like. And that's not an island. That's just the top of a mountain in the middle of the reservoir. So you get an idea that it's not flat terrain. It's kind of a valley, but it does have some mountains in it. This is towards the end of that drought, one of the worst that we've actually experienced over time. And we use that experience actually to design what we call a drought policy. So when we, every year, we think we're going to go into a drought, we start managing our reservoirs so that we actually can have enough water for our 2.6 million customers here in the Bay Area. This is just another shot of it. It gives you an idea of the steep sides. And, of course, it's just sheer rock at that point in time. Now, contrast that with what you saw in February 2017. So as Patrick talked about, we're looking, that's the O'Shaughnessy Dam right in the lower part of the frame, and you're looking up into the Tuolumne watershed. And that's the snowpack that we had in 2017, and this is the low snow. This is not the high snow. This is like really, this is not the good stuff. The good stuff is way up the hill. This is February 2017. If you are planning a trip this spring, I would say, book early. Oh, back one. Oops, sorry. Oh, sorry. I did it twice. If you're planning a trip up into the Sierras this spring, I would say that you might want to think about April, May time period. It's going to be spectacular. These are the waterfalls actually at Hetch Hetchy in February 2017. I've never seen all four of those waterfalls coming down in February in my career. So, and that's Wampama Falls in the background, and then Tulalip Falls are basically coming off Wampama Creek. And if you want to own that fourth waterfall in the foreground, you can name it. There you go, Patrick. I got a fundraiser for you. it's going to be spectacular. I would highly recommend it. Now, here's what the bad news is. Much like Scott talked about, and I really appreciated seeing his pictures because he made me feel better. This is just a mud and flood on one of our access roads. And why this is important is we actually planned an inspection and construction project in January and February of this year, not knowing what the year type would be like. And so we ran into a lot of road problems. We actually reconstruct a road in the middle of our construction project just to get people in and out. So everybody wants to know, is this the wettest year on record? What does it look like? And so there's a couple of lines here. The heavy black line is the medium. So that's 50% above, 50% below. The bottom line on this chart is actually 1977. That was one of the driest years on record. The blue line is actually 1983, one of the wettest years on record. And you can see this year we are trending the blue line, but probably won't get it as high as 1983. But it is pretty significant. You still have a lot of snow up on the hill. And this is what precipitation looks like at Hetch Hetchy. It's finally sort of leveled off. We're about 150% of normal or average. And, we thought we would be trending up, but, we could still have a few more storms, and that would be just fine with me. And this is a slide I always like because it shows the precipitation index at a couple of our upcountry stations. And you look at January and February, they're really, really heavy months up there, as it was here in the Bay Area. I'm not saying we didn't get our share of rain down here, but when you're doing a construction project, that's not really what you want to see. And this is the construction project that we actually did. It's called Mountain Tunnel. This is actually a photograph from 1918. And you can see it's a hard rock tunnel. And this carries water from Hetch Hetchy Reservoir down through, the San Joaquin Valley down to the Bay Area. So this is a single tunnel conduit. We don't have a backup. This tunnel goes out. We don't deliver water from the Hetch Hetchy system. And we hadn't been in this tunnel for decades, and we wanted to see what kind of condition it was. We really didn't know at this point. But the good news is they really built this one well. We had to actually cut what's called adits or doors into the tunnel. They're little. The usual size of an adit or doorway into these tunnels are 3 feet diameter. And, you squeeze through that to get into the tunnel, but we needed to get heavy equipment in there, so we actually built these doorways this winter so we can actually roll in, you know, little skid loaders and things of that nature. And this is looks like an inside of the tunnel. And what's nice, this is actually a line tunnel, and you can see some of the lining has kind of fallen off. And that's what we're really concerned about, because if the rock gave way, we wouldn't be able to deliver water. But the thing was, we actually poured into the concrete lining. The as-built drawings, as we call them, showed it was supposed to be a 6-inch lining, and it turned out to be about a 12 to 18-inch lining. So they didn't skimp on the concrete inside that tunnel. And those guys really did it all by hand. So then we basically have gone in and we've done repairs. We've kind of, during the midst of the storms, you know, we were able to do things. You can see kind of water filtering in because it's kind of just our groundwater coming in. Anyway, then kind of going, you know, everybody always asks me, like, what's next year going to be like? You know, you're through this year, and what's next year going to look like? And, you know, it's anybody's guess. We really don't know. We get through this year. We like to say that we fill our reservoirs by July 1st. Our reservoirs are already full. We probably have another, you know, several hundred thousand acre-feet of water. An acre-foot is about 326,000 gallons sitting up there ready to be melted and come down. The problem we're having this year is basically control. Everything that you saw from Bob, Scott, and Patrick is we want to be able to control that water, release it slowly into the river so that we don't create downstream damages. And right now we're working with our partners on the river, the Tuolumne and Modesto Irrigation Districts. They're downstream. They have a large reservoir. And this is the first time they've actually had water go over their spillway in 40 years, which when it goes over the spillway, it's uncontrolled. That's the worst thing you can have happen. And so you can cause a lot of flooding downstream and such. So it's going to be pretty spectacular this year, and we just hope to maintain control. And last but not least, we're going to start delivering groundwater here in San Francisco. We're really proud of that. So thank you.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and we've come to that point in our program for questions from the audience. And Michael is going to handle our questions and answers from our distinguished panel.
So the first question is, given the grim statistics you shared, I first wish this room had space for thousands of seats and certainly hope people are listening on the radio or podcast. How would you describe the state's political point of view, and what else can be done from a political perspective? For example, more funding, ample funding, and support for management.
There's an easy question.
And we're starting with Scott on this answer.
I think that was directed to Bob, since it was a question.
Yes. Yeah.
Sure. So, a huge question, and thank you. I share the sentiment and wish that there were thousands of more people that could learn about this situation. The political climate, I think right now, and you're seeing this on all facets, there are there's so much out there. So this is one critical issue. I see it. We see it. But there are so many critical issues out there right now. I think that this gets lost in the backscatter between all the other political things that are happening right now around the world. And I think it's hard to focus and capture people's attention on a critical issue like this when you're competing in a world where communications is so advanced. And the attention span of people is so shortened. In order to solve a problem that took hundreds of years to create, it's going to take a long time to solve a problem like this. It's not going to happen in the amount of time it takes to tweet or to, you know, send an instant message or something like that. This is going to take a long time to get out of this. We need to be investing with the mindset of a 20 or 30 years out to you know, reach a sustainable goal for this. there are things that can happen, and a lot of people are doing a lot of good work on this. Certainly, standing behind the efforts to maintain our energy policy and climate control policies will be helpful. It's generating a lot of revenue right now. The cap and trade program is generating revenue. We can do more work, I think, to strengthen the case that a lot more of that revenue needs to be going towards the types of projects that actually look at increasing the amount of carbon and greenhouse gases that are sequestered immediately. So that's just one example. I'll give my other colleagues an opportunity to add to that, because I think there's probably 100 answers to that question.
Thanks, Bob. I think we'll move on to another question, and this is directed towards Scott. What is the estimated cost of forest restoration, and what funds from state and federal government have been allocated?
So I can talk a little bit specifically about the Rim Fire and the estimated costs we have for reforestation of that landscape in particular. As Patrick pointed out, it's roughly 20% of the Tuolumne River watershed, and our reforestation efforts to date, as I explained, are only in the 1,000-acre range compared to how much was burned. The amount of funds that we see necessary to actually fully reforest the portion of the landscape that we've authorized to reforest, which is not the entire landscape, it's more like 10% of the landscape, is about $70 million. So that $70 million price tag doesn't just pay for baby trees. It pays for clearing the land in advance of putting those baby trees in, sowing those baby trees, hauling those baby trees, planting those baby trees, and then 10 years worth of care and feeding after the fact, because simply putting the tree in the ground does not make a new forest. There's a lot of competing vegetation out there. Brush and other species grow up. They crowd out the tree, they starve the tree, they strangle the tree from its water and its resources. And we have to clear that vegetation away if we want those seedlings to actually succeed. So there are subsequent re-entries that go in. It elevates the price tag. The amount of funds that are currently allocated to that effort are somewhere in the $10 million range. And that's thanks to the state of California successfully competing for something called the Natural Disaster and Resiliency Competition. This was something set up by the Department of Housing and Urban Development in response to catastrophes like Superstorm Sandy that hit Long Island and the East Coast. Qualifying federally declared disasters like the Rim Fire were eligible for funding from this stream. And the Rim Fire was the first example in which the Housing and Urban Development Department, urban development in a forest, okay, they saw the link. They saw the connection that we've all been talking about with natural resources and the downstream users of those benefits and resources, and they saw it fit to invest. So we're extremely excited to be working in partnership with the state, with the county of Tuolumne, and with our other partners in the area to put those $10 million worth of funds into reforestation over the next few years. But it's going to take at least seven times more of that just for reforestation efforts on one part of our disturbed landscape.
That's good. So, Patrick, you showed the slide of forests that have been thinned. So how does that compare to controlled burning?
So
the second part is, why isn't that just the national policy to do it that way?
So for decades, looking back to the 1920s, the Forest Service had a policy to put, it was called the 10 a.m. policy, and the idea was to put fires out by 10 a.m. the day after they were first spotted. And the focus was really on timber production, and so fires were really feared. There wasn't an understanding of how these forests really rely on fires to maintain their health. And so the idea was put the fires out, let's keep the trees alive so that we can harvest them. Coupled with that, harvesting policies focused on removing the largest trees, because that's where the most economic value was. So there's been kind of a long history, a long practice, and I think a culture of fire suppression and timber harvest. So nowadays, so fast forward many decades, we at some point stopped clear cutting, and at least in the Sierra Nevada. And so there has been a real buildup. Even though we stopped clear cutting, there was still a fire suppression policy. And so forests really became overly dense in that period. And now if you went and tried to just rely on fire to thin forests, you would end up with a large out-of-control fire. So you really have to go in and mechanically remove some of the trees, take out some of the small trees, remove some of these ladder fuels that flames get help link the ground with the forest canopy. You got to break that up, create some gaps, and then you can, in a controlled manner, come in and have a burn that removes some of the undergrowth, remove some of that small vegetation in a more controlled manner, like you would have had back in the early 1900s.
So this is the toss-up question. If we have a patch of Forest Service land not burned, should we be logging it?
It depends. It depends on a lot of different things. So in the Forest Service, we have multiple specialists who evaluate the landscape for its suitability for timber harvest, as well as its suitability for wilderness designation or its suitability as a watershed source, as well as its suitability for prescribed fire, like Patrick was just describing. The opportunity to thin, burn, manage a patch of ground depends on all of those things. Mechanical operations typically can't happen on slopes that are greater than 35% in steepness. So you have to have relatively flat ground in order to be able to use mechanical means to manage that part of the landscape. Whereas fire can be applied to any type of landscape. And so therefore it does indeed remain and can be one of our very valuable tools to help manage the fire. But yes, there are portions of the landscape that do need, as Patrick just described, mechanical thinning along with prescribed burning in order to get back to the conditions that we would like to see out in the forest.
And I'll just add, from a wildlife perspective, the large old trees that haven't been logged are incredibly valuable. These are trees, especially the ones that maybe are kind of deformed and kind of funky looking, they provide tremendous habitat for a whole host of species that are unique to the Sierra. The fisher, owls, and many other species really rely on the biggest trees for nesting, for perching, and for other activities. And so any trees that are, of these larger sizes, we need to be really careful in considering whether we want to take those out, because a lot of them are gone and we don't have them anymore. And so it does take great care when they go in and prescribe which trees they're going to come out. They need to be really careful about that.
So I'm going to throw this one towards Bob.
Okay.
Given what Scott said about selecting trees out, how do you view managing the forest where trees are dying? Do we go in and take them all out? Do we selectively take them out? You talked about 22 million acres of trees
just the scale of the issue at hand. Realistically, right now, California, we're working in a landscape where we're trying to deal with 102 million dead trees. Realistically, we'll be lucky if we are successful in, or even minimally successful in, removing the trees that are immediate hazards, that are going to fall on power lines, on roads, on canals, on campgrounds, on any kind of infrastructure, mm-hmm. water delivery infrastructure, railroad tracks, you name it. And that'll probably be equivalent to about 10% of the trees. So what that means is that 90% of those dead trees are going to stay standing in the forest. If we sort of maintain the level of management that we have now and the funding sources that we have and the resources that we have at hand to do that, what that means is all those trees are going to continue to decompose. And more importantly is they still remain a hazard. So it hampers the ability for us to go in and do any kind of mechanical work or pre-treatment work that could allow for subsequent controlled burn or prescribed burn in those areas, because it's too dangerous to send people in there when you've got all these widowmakers or trees that are just on the verge of falling over and hurting people. So we've created this situation or inherited this situation, combination of both, that it's one of those monumental problems. And like I said earlier, getting out of it is going to involve a lot of really creative attempts. But realistically, in the end, nature's going to play its course over the grand scale of this stuff, and we're just going to have to see. We have to wait till those trees fall down and they form pickup piles of pickup sticks that become huge fire hazards and completely obstruct access for the ability to manage it for anything. So we're going to have to – I wish I had better answer, better news, or better prognosis for the situation. But I think there are bright spots out there. And the question previous to this that referred to logging, you have to – to me, that implies that there's a commercial element to the activity. You know, logs I refer to as a saw log. And I think it's appropriate and probably necessary to look at selective harvesting, partly so that you can make the work in the forest pay to sustain the forests. Mm-hmm. and to reestablish and rebuild a sector that traditionally did work in the forest that is vanishing from the landscape right now. You know, try and find a logger. Try and find someone that knows how to run a chainsaw. You can't do it with an app. You know, you need more than two thumbs to run a chainsaw. You know, so we're losing that infrastructure. We're losing the human infrastructure that knows how to work in the woods. We're losing the physical infrastructure, the machinery, the mills, the biomass utilization facilities, et cetera, that can at least provide some kind of economical part of the equation to help maintain our forests in a resilient, healthy condition. And so a lot of work needs to be done in a lot of different areas to collectively solve the problem.
So I was going to follow up with a question to Scott. Where do these trees go?
Well, Bob already explained where some of them go. They decompose, fall down, form giant stacks of pickup sticks, and then they eventually burn. Again, as others have pointed out, these were fire-adapted ecosystems, and fire will eventually happen sooner or later. Imagine trying to push a bulldozer through a pile of 10 to 15 to 20-inch diameter trees that are all just falling in and jackstrawed with each other. You get about 5 feet, and the bulldozer can't go anymore. Air tankers don't put out fires. They help reduce the speed of a spread of a fire so that ground forces, people with chainsaws, people with shovels, and bulldozers can actually stop the fire from spreading. If they can't push fire line through those stacks of fallen timber, they will have to just back up and watch it burn. The areas that we are actually thinning, we're sending trees to sawmills. The limited infrastructure that does exist is still taking some of these beetle-killed and drought-killed trees, as well as the biomass power plants. The state recently reissued new contracts to some of the biomass energy facilities up and down the state, which we see as not only a key component of our energy infrastructure, but also a key component to our land management infrastructure. So whether it burns up, whether it gets cut down and sent to a sawmill or whether it gets cut down and sent to a biomass utilization facility, there are eventual destinations for these trees.
So have we created incentives for local homeowners to take out their dead trees, you know, to expediting permit processes, things of that nature? Because we want to get those hazards removed. So, Bob, you kind of...
I'm sure we all have an answer for that. Might they might be different. we're good at creating hammers. So we've created the hammer, you know, at the level where homeowners are actually mandated by law to maintain defensible space around their properties. The enforcement of that law is scattered and not there. It also doesn't help the homeowner. And I think now when the situation has become as dire as it has, and the scale of the problem is covering entire communities, we're starting to look at, oh, we need some incentives. We need to develop some other pathways and avenues to provide funding assistance or local assistance to these areas. And people are stepping up to the plate. You know, utilities are stepping up to the plate. PG&E is stepping up to the plate and helping in a lot of these communities to move this stuff. You know, anytime there's a dollar to be made, people are going to show up. So that's just a given, you know. And just to add a little bit to what Scott was saying, you know, there are some, when you get into the weeds, you know, it depends where the wood comes from. You know, wood taken from federal land has some restrictions on it that prohibit it from being sold in certain markets, particularly overseas. Wood taken off of private land or SRA or state responsibility areas has the ability to be sold overseas, and right now that market is growing and part of that is being filled by a lot of the dead trees that are being pulled off of our forests right now in California. They're being shipped to China, and it's being sawn up, rough sawn into wood for concrete forms. So they're building at such a huge clip right now. They need wood, one, to power their power plants, so they'll use it to power plants, or they'll rough cut it because it's not structural. A lot of the wood that's coming out of here is checked, which means it's full of cracks, and it won't meet any kind of structural grade, so they're cutting it up and they're using it for concrete forms. And then what happens to it after that? Who knows? It'll end up in a landfill. It'll end up burned. Hopefully it'll end up burned somewhere where it's clean and produces some kind of electricity and offsets some other kind of energy production impact that could happen. So
that's good. So I get the last question.
Yeah, you get one. You want one of us to read it for you? Come on.
Thank you. The question is, why would you tap into groundwater when you have surplus surface water, water that someday would evaporate? Shouldn't you save the surplus or the subsurface water for a time when surface water is scarce? And the answer is yes and no. The answer is yes, you want to save the subsurface water for when water is scarce, and we're actually doing that with three cities, south of San Francisco, Daly City, South San Francisco, and San Bruno, where we have excess surface water, we give them that water, and they stop pumping groundwater. So then when we have a drought, they go to the groundwater, and we don't have to have as much surface water come in. And the other part of it is why you want to keep your wells kind of running is you want to keep them kind of fresh. So if you have an emergency and we get cut off from the Hetchy system, we'll have water in San Francisco. That's why we're doing it. So I'll stop there.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Thank you for being with us tonight. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club is our 106th year of enlightened discussion. And we first want to thank our wonderful speakers tonight and actually congratulate them for coming and being here and taking the time to be with us tonight. And as you know, the Commonwealth Club is very proud of the speakers that we have, and every time I come to a program for the environment, I'm extremely proud and touched by the knowledge and the expertise that they bring to us. So I want to specifically thank our our panel tonight, Bob Kingman, who's Assistant Executive Officer of the Sierra Nevada Conservancy, Scott Tannenberg, who's Acting Forest Supervisor, Stanislaus National Forest, Patrick Coppell, is it? Patrick, I'm going to get this wrong every time.
Coppell,
who's Executive Director of the Tuolumne River Trust, and Michael Carlin, who's our Deputy General Manager of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. So let's give them a big hand of applause. I also want to thank our audience here tonight. We've had some really wonderful questions, and I've learned a lot. So for those of you who are in our audience tonight and those of you who gave us questions, thank you so much. You also are able to listen to our recordings on our audio tapes and also on our podcasts. So if you want to find that information for our programs, go to the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. So a big thank you and a big round of applause for our audiences here and those who are listening to us on the audio and our podcast. So one more hand of a big hand of applause. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Again, thank you for being with us. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion. Can you believe that? All these years. This meeting is adjourned.